hands and eyes like mine. He'd have gold on his fingers, cologne on his neck, a silk shirt, good leather shoes. The whole barrio would come out to greet him. He'd kiss Mommy and Rafa and shake Abuelo's reluctant hand, and then he'd see me behind everyone else. "What's wrong with that one?" he'd ask, and Mommy would say, "He doesn't know you." Squatting down so that his pale yellow dress socks showed, he'd trace the scars on my arms and on my head. "Junior," he'd finally say, his stubbled face in front of mine, his thumb tracing a circle on my cheek. Drown. My mother tells me Beto's home, waits for me to say something, but I keep watching the TV. Only when she's in bed do I put on my jacket and swing through the neighborhood to see. He's a pato now. But 2 years ago we were friends, and he would walk into the apartment without knocking, his heavy voice rousing my mother from the Spanish upper room and drawing me up from the basement, a voice that crackled and made you think of uncles or grandfathers. We were raging then, crazy the way we stole, broke windows, the way we pissed on people's steps and then challenged them to come out and stop us. Beto was leaving for college at the end of the summer, and was delirious from the thought of it. He hated everything about the neighborhood, the break-apart buildings, the little strips of grass, the piles of garbage around the cans, and the dump, especially the dump. "I don't know how you can do it," he said to me. "I would just find me a job anywhere and go." "Yeah," I said. I wasn't like him. I had another year to go in high school. No promises elsewhere. Days we spent in the mall or out in the parking lot playing stickball. But nights were what we waited for. The heat in the apartments was like something heavy that had come inside to die. Families arranged on their porches, the glow from their TVs washing blue against the brick. From my family apartment, you could smell the pear trees that had been planted years ago, 4 to a quart, probably to save us all from asphyxiation. Nothing moved fast. Even the daylight was slow to fade. But as soon as night settled, Beto and I headed down to the community center and sprang the fence into the pool. We were never alone. Every kid with legs was there. We lunged from the boards and swam out of the deep end, wrestling and farting around. At around midnight, abuelas, with their night hair swirled around spiky rollers, shouted at us from their apartment windows, "Sinvergüenzas! Go home!" I pass his apartment, but the windows are dark. I put my ear to the busted-up door and hear only the familiar hum of the air conditioner. I haven't decided yet if I'll talk to him. I can go back to my dinner, and 2 years will become three. Even from 4 blocks off, I can hear the racket from the pool, radios too, and wonder if we ever were that loud. Little has changed. Not the stink of chlorine, not the bottles exploding against the lifeguard station. I hook my fingers through the plastic-coated hurricane fence. Something tells me that he will be here. I hop the fence, feeling stupid when I sprawl on the dandelions and the grass. "Nice one," somebody calls out. "Fuck me," I say. I'm not the oldest motherfucker in the place, but it's close. I take off my shirt and my shoes and then knife in. Many of the kids here are younger brothers of the people I used to go to school with. Two of them swim past, black and Latino, and they pause when they see me, recognizing the guy who sells them their shitty dope. The crackheads have their own man, Lucero, and some other guy who drives in from Patterson, the only full-time commuter in the area. The water feels good. Starting at the deep end, I glide over the slick-tiled bottom without kicking up a spume or making a splash. Sometimes another swimmer churns past me, more a disturbance of water than a body. I can still go far without coming up. While everything above is loud and bright, everything below is whispers. And always the risk of coming up to find the cops stabbing their searchlights out across the water. And then everyone running, wet feet slapping against the concrete, yelling, "Fuck you, officers! You puto sucios, fuck you!" When I'm tired, I wade through to the shallow end, past some kid who's kissing his girlfriend, watching me as though I'm going to try to cut in. And I sit near the sign that runs the pool during the day. No horseplay, no running, no defecating, no urinating, no expectorating. At the bottom, someone has scrawled in, "No whites, no fat chicks." I laugh. Beto hadn't known what expectorating meant, though he was the one leaving for college. I told him, spitting a greener by the side of the pool. "Shit," he said. "Where did you learn that?" I shrugged. "Tell me." He hated when I knew something he didn't. He put his hands on my shoulders and pushed me under. He was wearing a cross and cut-off jeans. He was stronger than me, and held me down until water flooded my nose and throat. Even then I didn't tell him. He thought I didn't read. Not even dictionaries. We live alone. My mother has enough for the rent and groceries, and I cover the phone bill, sometimes the cable. She's so quiet that most of the time I'm startled to find her in the apartment. I'll enter a room and she'll stir, detaching herself from the cracking plaster walls, from the stained cabinets, and fright will pass through me like a wire. She's discovered the secret to silence. Pouring café without a splash, walking between rooms as if gliding on a cushion of felt, crying without a sound. "You have traveled to the East and learned many secret things," I've told her. "You're like a shadow warrior." "And you're like a crazy," she says. "Like a big crazy." When I come in, she's still awake, her hands picking clots of lint from her skirt. I put a towel down on the sofa and we watch television together. We settle on the Spanish language news. Drama for her, violence for me. Today a child has survived a 7-story fall, busting nothing but his diaper. The hysterical babysitter, about 300 pounds of her, is headbutting the microphone.
"It's a goddamn miraclevilla," she cries.
My mother asks me if I found Beto. I tell her that I didn't look.
"That's too bad. He was telling me that he might be starting at a school for business."
"So what?"
She's never understood why we don't speak anymore. I've tried to explain, all wise-like, that everything changes. But she thinks that sort of saying is only around so you can prove it wrong.
"He asked me what you were doing."
"What did you say?"
"I told him you were fine."
"You should have told him I moved."
"And what if he ran into you?"
"I'm not allowed to visit my mother." She notices the tightening of my arms.
"You should be more like me and your father. Can't you see him watching television?" "I was angry at him, wasn't I? But now we can talk to each other."
"Am I watching television here or what?" Saturdays, she asks me to take her to the mall. As a son, I feel I owe her that much. Even though neither of us have a car, and we have to walk 2 miles through redneck territory to catch the M-15. Before we head out, she drags us through the apartment to make sure the windows are locked. She can't reach the latches, so she has me test them. With the air conditioner on, we never open windows, but I go through the routine anyway. Putting my hand on the latch is not enough. She wants to hear it rattle.
"This place just isn't safe," she tells me. "Lorena got lazy and look what they did to her. They punched her and kept her locked up in her place. Those morenos ate all her food and even made phone calls." "Phone calls!"
That's why we don't have long distance, I tell her. But she shakes her head.
That's not funny, she says.
She doesn't go out much, so when she does, it's a big deal. She dresses up, even puts on makeup. Which is why I don't give her lip about taking her to the mall, even though I usually make a fortune on Saturdays selling to those kids going down to Belmar or out to Spruce Run. I recognize, like, half the kids on the bus. I keep my head buried in my cap, praying that nobody tries to score. She watches the traffic, her hands somewhere inside her purse, doesn't say a word. When we arrive at the mall, I give her $50.
Buy something, I say, hating the image I have of her, picking through the sale bins, wrinkling everything.
Back in the day, my father would give her $100 at the end of each summer for my new clothes, and she would take nearly a week to spend it, even though it never amounted to more than a couple of t-shirts and two pairs of jeans. She folds the bills into a square.
I'll see you at 3, she says.
I wander through the stores, staying in sight of the cashiers, so they won't have reason to follow me. The circuit I make has not changed since my looting days. Bookstore, record store, comic book shop, Macy's. Me and Beto used to steal like mad from these places. $200-$300 of shit in an outing. Our system was simple. We walked into a store with a shopping bag and came out loaded. Back then, security wasn't tight. The only trick was in the exit. We stopped right at the entrance of the store and checked out some worthless piece of junk to stop people from getting suspicious. What do you think? We asked each other. Would she like it? Both of us had seen bad shoplifters at work. All grab and run, nothing smooth about them. Not us. We idled out of the store slow, like a fat 70s car. At this, Beto was the best. He even talked to mall security, asked them for directions, his bag all loaded up and me standing 10 feet away shitting my pants. When he finished, he smiled, swinging his shopping bag up to hit me. You gotta stop that messing around, I told him. I'm not going to jail for bullshit like that. You don't go to jail for shoplifting. They just turn you over to your old man. I don't know about you, but my pops hits like a motherfucker. He laughed. You know my dad. He flexed his hands. The nigger's got arthritis. My mother never suspected, even when my clothes couldn't all fit in my closet. But my father wasn't that easy. He knew what things cost, and knew that I didn't have a regular job. You're going to get caught, he told me one day. Just you wait. When you do, I'll show them everything you've taken, and then they'll throw your stupid ass away like a bad piece of meat. He was a charmer, my pop. A real asshole. But he was right. Nobody can stay smooth forever. Especially kids like us. One day at the bookstore, we didn't even hide the drops. 4 issues of the same Playboy for kicks. Enough audiobooks to start our own library. No last-minute juke either. The lady who stepped in front of us didn't look old, even with her white hair. Her silk shirt was half unbuttoned, and a silver horn necklace sat on the freckled top of her chest. I'm sorry, fellows, but I have to check your bag, she said. I kept moving, and looked back all annoyed like she was asking us for a quarter or something. Beto got polite and stopped. No problem, he said, slamming the heavy bag into her face. She hit the cold tile with a squawk, her palm slapping the ground. There you go, Beto said. Security found us across from the bus stop under a Jeep Cherokee. A bus had come and gone, both of us too scared to take it, imagining a plain clothes waiting to clap the cuffs on. I remember that when the rent-a-cop tapped his nightstick against the fender and said, "You little shits better come out here real slow," I started to cry. Beto didn't say a word, his face stretched out and gray, his hand squeezing mine, the bones in our fingers pressing together. Nights I drink with Alex and Danny. The Malibu bar is no good, just washouts and the sucias we can con into joining us. We drink too much, roar at each other, and make the skinny bartender move closer to the phone. On the wall hangs a cork dartboard, and a Brunswick gold crown blocks the bathroom. Its bumper squashed, the felt pulled like old skin. When the bar begins to shake back and forth like a rumba, I call it a night and go home, through the fields that surround the apartments. In the distance you can see the Raritan, as shiny as an earthworm, the same river my homeboy goes to school on. The dump has long since shut down, and grass has spread over it like a sickly fuzz. And from where I stand, my right hand directing a colorless stream of piss downward, the landfill might be the top of a blonde head, square and old. In the mornings I run. My mother is already up, dressing for her house cleaning job. She says nothing to me, would rather point to the mangu she has prepared than speak. I run 3 miles easily, could have pushed a fourth if I were in the mood. I keep an eye out for the recruiter who prowls around our neighborhood in his dark K-car. We've spoken before. He was out of uniform and called me over, jovial, and I thought I was helping some white dude with directions. Would you mind if I asked you a question? No. Do you have a job? Not right now. Would you like one? A real career, more than you'll get around here. I remember stepping back. Depends on what it is, I said. Son, I know somebody who's hiring. It's the United States government. Well, sorry, but I ain't army material. That's exactly what I used to think, he said, his 10 piggy fingers buried in his carpeted steering wheel. But now I have a house, a car, a gun, and a wife. Discipline. Loyalty. Can you say that you have those things? Even one? He's a southerner, red-haired, his drawl so out of place that the people around here laugh just hearing him. I take to the bushes when I see his car on the road. These days my guts feel loose and cold, and I want to be away from here. He won't have to show me his desert eagle, or flash the photos of the skinny Filipino girl sucking dick. He'll only have to smile and name the places, and I'll listen. When I reach the apartment, I lean against my door, waiting for my heart to slow, for the pain to lose its edge. I hear my mother's voice, a whisper from the kitchen. She sounds hurt or nervous, maybe both. At first I'm terrified that Beto's inside with her, but then I look and see the phone cord swinging lazily. She's talking to my father, something she knows I disapprove of. He's in Florida now, a sad guy who calls her and begs for money. He swears that if she moves down there, he'll leave the woman he's living with. These are lies, I've told her, but she still calls him. His words coil inside of her, wrecking her sleep for days. She opens the refrigerator door slightly so that the whir of the compressor masks their conversation. I walk in on her and hang up the phone. That's enough, I say. She's startled, her hand squeezing the loose folds of her neck. That was him, she says quietly. On school days, Beto and I chilled at the stop together, but as soon as that bus came over the Parkwood Hill, I got to thinking about how I was failing gym and screwing up math and how I hated every single living teacher on the planet. I'll see you in the PM, I said. He was already standing on line. I just stood back and grinned, my hands in my pockets. With our bus drivers, you didn't have to hide. Two of them didn't give a rat fuck, and the third one, the Brazilian preacher, was too busy talking Bible to notice anything but the traffic in front of him. Being truant without a car was no easy job, but I managed. I watched a lot of TV, and when it got boring, I trooped down to the mall or the Sayreville Library, where you could watch old documentaries for free. I always came back to the neighborhood late, so the bus wouldn't pass me on Ernston, and nobody could yell, "Asshole!" out the windows. Beto would usually be home or down by the swings, but other times, he wouldn't be around at all. Out visiting other neighborhoods. He knew a lot of folks I didn't. A messed up black kid from Madison Park. Two brothers who were into that NY club scene, who spent money on platform shoes and leather backpacks. I'd leave a message with his parents and then watch some more TV. The next day, he'd be out at the bus stop, too busy smoking a cigarette to say much about the day before. "You need to learn how to walk the world," he told me. "There's a lot out there." Some nights, me and the boys drive to New Brunswick. A nice city. The Raritan's so low and silty that you don't have to be Jesus to walk over it. We hit the Melody and the Roxy, stare at the college girls. We drink a lot and then spin out onto the dance floor. None of the chicas ever dance with us, but a glance or a touch can keep us talking shit for hours. Once the clubs close, we go to the Franklin Diner, gorge ourselves on pancakes, and then after we've smoked our pack, head home. Danny passes out in the back seat, and Alex cranks the window down to keep the wind in his eyes. He's fallen asleep in the past, wrecked two cars before this one. The streets have been picked clean of students and townies, and we blow through every light, red or green. At the old bridge turnpike, we pass the fag bar, which never seems to close. Patos are all over the parking lot, drinking and talking. Sometimes Alex will stop by the side of the road and say, "Excuse me." When somebody comes over from the bar, he'll point his plastic pistol at them, just to see if they'll run or shit their pants. Tonight he just puts his head out the window. "Fuck you!" he shouts, and then settles back in his seat laughing. "That's original," I say. He puts his head out the window again. "Eat me then!"
"Yeah," Danny mumbles from the back. "Eat me."
Twice. That's it. The first time was at the end of that summer. We'd just come back from the pool and were watching a porn video at his parents' apartment. His father was a nut for these tapes, ordering them from wholesalers in California and Grand Rapids. Beto used to tell me how his pop would watch them in the middle of the day, not caring a lick about his mom's, who spent the time in the kitchen, taking hours to cook a pot of rice and gandules. Beto would sit down with his pop and neither of them would say a word, except to laugh when somebody caught it in the eye or the face. We were an hour into the new movie, some vaina that looked like it had been filmed in the apartment next door, when he reached into my shorts. "What the fuck are you doing?" I asked, but he didn't stop. His hand was dry. I kept my eyes on the television, too scared to watch. I came right away, smearing the plastic sofa covers. My legs started shaking and suddenly I wanted out. He didn't say anything to me as I left, just sat there watching the screen. The next day he called, and when I heard his voice, I was cool, but I wouldn't go to the mall or anywhere else. My mother sensed that something was wrong and pestered me about it, but I told her to leave me the fuck alone. And my pops, who was home on a visit, stirred himself from the couch to slap me down. Mostly, I stayed in the basement, terrified that I would end up abnormal, a fucking pato. But he was my best friend, and back then, that mattered to me more than anything. This alone got me out of the apartment and over to the pool that night. He was already there, his body pale and flabby under the water. "Hey," he said, "I was beginning to worry about you." "Nothing to worry about," I said. We swam and didn't talk much, and later we watched a sky top crew pull a bikini top from a girl stupid enough to hang out alone.
Give it, she said, covering herself. But these kids howled, holding it up over her head, the shiny laces flopping just out of reach. When they began to pluck at her arms, she walked away, leaving them to try the top on over their flat pecs. He put his hand on my shoulder, my pulse a code under his palm. Let's go, he said. Unless, of course, you're not feeling good. I'm feeling fine, I said. Since his parents worked nights, we pretty much owned the place until 6 the next morning. We sat in front of his television, in our towels, his hands bracing against my abdomen and thighs. I'll stop if you want, he said, and I didn't respond. After I was done, he laid his head in my lap. I wasn't asleep or awake, but caught somewhere in between, rocked slowly back and forth the way surf holds junk against the shore, rolling it over and over. In 3 weeks he was leaving. Nobody can touch me, he kept saying. We'd visited the school, and I'd seen how beautiful the campus was, with all the students drifting from dorm to class. I thought of how in high school our teachers loved to crowd us into their lounge every time a space shuttle took off from Florida. One teacher, whose family had 2 grammar schools named after it, compared us to the shuttles. A few of you are going to make it. Those are the orbiters. But the majority of you are just going to burn out. Going nowhere. He dropped his hand onto his desk. I could already see myself losing altitude, fading, the earth spread out beneath me hard and bright. I had my eyes closed and the television was on, and when the hallway door crashed open, he jumped up and I nearly cut my dick off, struggling with my shorts. It's just the neighbor, he said, laughing. He was laughing, but I was saying, fuck this, and getting my clothes on. I believe I see him in his father's bottomed-out Cadillac heading towards the turnpike, but I can't be sure. He's probably back in school already. I deal close to home, trooping up and down the same dead-end street where the kids drink and smoke. These punks joke with me, pat me down for taps, sometimes too hard. Now that strip mall's line Route 9, a lot of folks have part-time jobs. The kids stand around smoking in their aprons, name tags dangling heavily from pockets. When I get home, my sneakers are filthy, so I take an old toothbrush to their soles, scraping the crap into the tub. My mother has thrown open the windows and propped open the door. It's cool enough, she explains. She's prepared dinner. Rice and beans, fried cheese, tostones. Look what I bought, she says, showing me 2 blue t-shirts. They were 2 for 1, so I bought you one. Try it on. It fits tight, but I don't mind. She cranks up the television. A movie dubbed into Spanish, a classic, one that everyone knows. The actors throw themselves around, passionate, but their words are plain and deliberate. It's hard to imagine anybody going through life this way. I pull out the plug of bills from my pockets. She takes it from me, her fingers soothing the creases. A man who treats his plata like this doesn't deserve to spend it, she says. We watch the movie, and the 2 hours together makes us friendly. She puts her hand on mine. Near the end of the film, just as our heroes are about to fall apart under a hail of bullets, she takes off her glasses and kneads her temples, the light of the television flickering across her face. She watches another minute, and then her chin lifts to her chest. Almost immediately, her eyelashes begin to tremble. A quiet semaphore. She is dreaming. Dreaming of Boca Raton. Of strolling under the jacarandas with my father. You can't be anywhere forever, was what Beto used to say. what he said to me the day I went to see him off. He handed me a gift, a book, and after he was gone I threw it away. Didn't even bother to open it and read what he'd written. I let her sleep until the end of the movie, and when I wake her she shakes her head, grimacing. "You better check those windows," she says. I promise her I will.
Boyfriend. I should have been careful with the weed. Most people it just fucks up. Me. It makes me sleepwalk. And wouldn't you know, I woke up in the hallway of our building feeling like I'd been stepped on by my high school marching band. My ass would have been there all night if the folks in the apartment below hadn't been having themselves a big old fight at 3 in the morning. I was too fried to move, at least right away. Boyfriend was trying to snake girlfriend, saying he needed space, and she was like, "Motherfucker, I'll give you all the space you need." I knew boyfriend a little. I saw him at the bars and saw some of the girls he used to bring home while she was away. He just needed more space to cheat. "Fine," he said. But every time he went for the door, she got to crying and would be like, "Why are you doing this?" They sounded a lot like me and my old girlfriend Loretta. But I swore to myself that I would stop thinking about her ass, even though every Cleopatra-looking Latina in the city made me stop and wish she would come back to me. By the time boyfriend got himself into the hallway, I was already in my apartment. Girlfriend would not stop crying. Twice she stopped. She must have heard me moving around right above her, and both times I held my breath until she started up again. I followed her into the bathroom, the two of us separated by floor, wires, and some pipes. She kept saying, "Ese fucking pepetón," and washed her face over and over again. It would have broken my heart if it hadn't been so damn familiar. I guess I'd gotten numb to that sort of thing. I had heart leather like walruses got blubber. The next day I told my boy Harold what happened, and he said, "Too bad for her." I guess so. If I didn't have my own women problems, I'd say let's go comfort the widow. She ain't our type. The hell she ain't. Homegirl was too beautiful, too high class for a couple of knuckleheads like us. Never saw her in a t-shirt or without jewelry. And her boyfriend, olvídate. That nigger could have been a model. Hell, they both could have been models, which is what they probably were, considering that I never heard word one pass between them about a job or a fucking boss. People like these were untouchables to me, raised on some other planet, and then transplanted into my general vicinity to remind me how bad I was living. What was worse was how much Spanish they shared. None of my girlfriends ever spoke Spanish, even Loretta, of the Puerto Rican attitudes. The closest thing for me was this black chick who spent 3 years in Italy. She liked to talk that shit in bed, and said she'd gone with me because I reminded her of some of the Sicilian men she'd known, which was why I never called her again. Boyfriend came around a couple of times that week for his things, and I guess to finish the job. He was a confident prick. He'd listened to what she had to say, arguments that had taken her hours to put together, and then he would sigh and say it didn't matter. He needed his space, punto. She let him fuck her every time, maybe hoping that it would make him stay, but, you know, once somebody gets a little escape velocity going, ain't no play in the world that will keep them from leaving. I would listen to them going at it and I would be like, damn, ain't nothing more shabby than those farewell fucks. I know. Me and Loretta had enough of those to go around. Difference was, we never talked the way these two would. About our days. Not even when we were cool together. We'd lay there and listen to the world outside. To the loud boys, the cars, the pigeons. Back then, I didn't have a clue what she was thinking, but now I know what to pencil into all those empty thought bubbles. Escape. Escape. These two had a thing about the bathroom. Each one of his visits ended up there, which was fine by me. It was where I could hear them best. I don't know why I started following her life, but it seemed like a good thing to do. Most of the time I thought people, even at their worst, were pretty fucking boring. I guess I wasn't busy with anything else, especially not women. I was taking time off, waiting for the last of my Loretta wreckage to drift out of sight. The bathroom. Girlfriend talked a mile a minute about her day, how she saw a fistfight on the C train, how somebody liked her necklace, and boyfriend with a smooth Barry White voice just kept going, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." They'd shower together, and if she wasn't talking, she was going down on him. All you would hear down there was the water smacking the bottom of the tub and him going, "Yeah, yeah." He wasn't sticking around, though. That was obvious. He was one of those dark-skinned, smooth-faced brothers that women kill for. And I knew for a fact, having seen his ass in action at the local spots, that he liked to get over on the white girls. She didn't know nothing about his little Rico Suave routine. It would have wrecked her. I used to think those were the barrio rules. Latinos and blacks in, whites out. A place we downcats weren't supposed to go. But love teaches you. Clears your head of any rules. Loretta's new boy was Italian, worked on Wall Street. When she told me about him, we were still going out. We were on the promenade, and she said to me, "I like him. He's a hard worker." No amount of heart leather could stop something like that from hurting. After one of their showers, boyfriend never came back. No phone calls, no nothing. She called a lot of her friends, one she hadn't spoken to in the longest. I survived through my boys. I didn't have to call out for help. It was easy for them to say, "Forget her sellout ass. That's not the sort of woman you need. Look how light you are." No doubt she was already shopping for the lightest. Girlfriend spent her time crying, either in the bathroom or in front of the TV. I spent my time listening and calling around for a job. Or smoking or drinking. A bottle of rum and 2 sixes of Presidente a week. One night I got the cojones to ask her up for café, which was mighty manipulative of me. She hadn't had much human contact the whole month, except with the delivery guy from the Japanese restaurant, a Colombian dude I always said hi to. So what the hell was she going to say? No? She seemed glad to hear my name. And when she threw open the door, I was surprised to see her looking smart and watchful. She said she'd be right up, and when she sat down across from me at the kitchen table, she had on makeup and a rose gold necklace. "You have a lot more light in your apartment than I do," she said. Which was a nice call. About all I had in the apartment was light. I played Andres Jimenez for her, you know. "Yo quiero que mi borinquen sea libre y soberana." And then we drank a pot of café. "El pico," I told her. "Nothing but the best." We didn't have much to talk about. She was depressed and tired, and I had the worst gas of my life. Twice I had to excuse myself. Twice in an hour. She must have thought that bizarre as hell, but both times I came out of the bathroom, she was staring deeply into her café. The way the fortune tellers will do back on the island. Crying all the time had made her more beautiful. Grief will do that sometimes. Not for me. Loretta had left months ago and I still looked like hell. Having girlfriend in the apartment only made me feel shabbier. She picked up a cheap seed from a crack in the table and smiled. "Do you smoke?" I asked. "It makes me break out," she said. "Makes me sleepwalk." "Honey will stop that. It's an old Caribbean cure. I had a tío who would sleepwalk. 1 teaspoon a night took it out of him." "Wow," I said. That night, she put on a freestyle tape.
Noelle, maybe. And I can hear her moving around her apartment. I wouldn't have put it past her to have been a dancer. I never tried the honey, and she never came back. Whenever I saw her on the stairs, we would trade highs, but she never slowed down to talk, never gave a smile or any other kind of encouragement. I took that as a hint. At the end of the month, she got her hair cut short. No more straighteners, no more science fiction combs. "I like that," I told her. I was coming back from the liquor store and she was on her way out with a woman friend. "Makes you look fierce." She smiled. That's exactly what I wanted.
Edison, New Jersey.
The first time we try to deliver the gold crown, the lights are on in the house, but no one lets us in. I bang on the front door and Wayne hits the back and I can hear our double drum shaking the windows. Right then, I have this feeling that someone is inside laughing at us.
"This guy better have a good excuse," Wayne says, lumbering around the newly planted rose bushes. "This is bullshit."
"You're telling me," I say. But Wayne's the one who takes this job too seriously. He pounds some more on the door, his face jiggling. A couple of times he raps on the windows, tries squinting through the curtains. I take a more philosophical approach. I walk over to the ditch that has been cut next to the road, a drainage pipe half filled with water, and sit down. I smoke and watch a mama duck and her three ducklings scavenge the grassy bank and then float downstream like they're on the same string.
"Beautiful," I say, but Wayne doesn't hear. He's banging on the door with the staple gun. At 9, Wayne picks me up at the showroom, and by then I have our route planned out. The order forms tell me everything I need to know about the customers we'll be dealing with that day. If someone is just getting a 52-inch card table delivered, then you know they aren't going to give you too much of a hassle. But they also aren't going to tip. Those are those Spotswood, Sayreville, and Perth Amboy deliveries. The pool tables go north to the rich suburbs, Livingston, Ridgewood, Bedminster. You should see our customers. Doctors, diplomats, surgeons, presidents of universities, ladies in slacks and silk tops who sport thin watches you could trade in for a car, who wear comfortable leather shoes. Most of them prepare for us by laying down a path of yesterday's Washington Post from the front door to the game room. I make them pick it all up. I say, "Carajo, what if we slip? Do you know what 200 pounds of slate could do to a floor?" The threat of property damage puts the chop-chop in their step. The best customers leave us alone until the bill has to be signed. Every now and then we'll be given water in paper cups. Few have offered us more, though a dentist from Ghana once gave us a 6-pack of Heineken while we worked. Sometimes the customer has to jet to the store for cat food or a newspaper while we're in the middle of a job.
"I'm sure you'll be all right," they say. They never sound too sure.
"Of course," I say. "Just show us where the silver's at." The customers ha-ha and we-ha-ha, and then they agonize over leaving, linger by the front door, trying to memorize everything they own, as if they don't know where to find us, who we work for. Once they're gone, I don't have to worry about anyone bothering me. I put down the ratchet, crack my knuckles, and explore, usually while Wayne is smoothing out the felt and doesn't need help. I take cookies from the kitchen, razors from the bathroom cabinets. Some of these houses have 20-30 rooms. On the ride back, I figure out how much loot it would take to fill up all that space. I've been caught roaming around plenty of times, but you'd be surprised how quickly someone believes you're looking for the bathroom if you don't jump when you're discovered, if you just say hi. After the paperwork's been signed, I have a decision to make. If the customer has been good and tipped well, we call it even and leave. If the customer has been an ass, maybe they yelled, maybe they let their kids throw golf balls at us, I ask for the bathroom. Wayne will pretend that he hasn't seen this before. He'll count the drill bits while the customer, or the maid, guides the vacuum over the floor.
Excuse me, I say.
I let them show me the way to the bathroom. Usually I already know. And once the door is shut, I cram bubble bath drops into my pockets and throw fist-sized wads of toilet paper into the toilet. I take a dump if I can and leave that for them. Most of the time, Wayne and I work well together. He's the driver and the money man, and I do the lifting and handle the assholes. Tonight we're on our way to Lawrenceville, and he wants to talk to me about Charlene, one of the showroom girls, the one with the blowjob lips. I haven't wanted to talk about women in months, not since the girlfriend. I really want to pile her, he tells me. Maybe on one of the Madisons. Man, I say, cutting my eyes towards him. Don't you have a wife or something? He gets quiet. I'd still like to pile her, he says defensively. And what will that do? Why does it have to do anything? Twice this year, Wayne's cheated on his wife, and I've heard it all, the before and the after. The last time, his wife nearly tossed his ass out to the dogs. Neither of the women seemed worth it to me. One of them was even younger than Charlene. Wayne can be a moody guy, and this is one of those nights. He slouches in the driver's seat and swerves through traffic, riding other people's bumpers like I've told him not to do. I don't need a collision or a 4-hour silent treatment. So I try to forget that I think his wife is good people and ask him if Charlene's given him any signals. He slows the truck down. Signals like you wouldn't believe, he says. On the days we have no deliveries, the boss has us working at the showroom, selling cards and poker chips and Mancala boards. Wayne spends his time skeezing the salesgirls and dusting shelves. He's a big, goofy guy. I don't understand why the girls dig his shit. One of those mysteries of the universe. The boss keeps me in the front of the store, away from the pool tables. He knows I'll talk to the customers, tell them not to buy the cheap models. I'll say shit like, "Stay away from those Bristols. Wait until you can get something real." Only when he needs my Spanish will he let me help on a sale. Since I'm no good at cleaning or selling slot machines, I slouch behind the front register and steal. I don't ring anything up and pocket what comes in. I don't tell Wayne. He's too busy running his fingers through his beard, keeping the waves on his nappy head in order. $100 haul's not unusual for me. And back in the day, when the girlfriend used to pick me up, I'd buy her anything she wanted. Dresses, silver rings, lingerie. Sometimes I blew it all on her. She didn't like the stealing, but hell, we weren't made out of loot. And I liked going into a place and saying, "Heva, pick out anything. It's yours." This is the closest I've come to feeling rich. Nowadays, I take the bus home, and the cash stays with me. I sit next to this 300-pound rock-and-roll chick who washes dishes at the Friendlies. She tells me about the roaches she kills with her water nozzle, boils the wings right off them. On Thursday, I buy myself lottery tickets, 10 quick picks and a couple of pick fours. I don't bother with the little stuff. The second time we bring the gold crown, the heavy curtain next to the door swings up like a Spanish fan. A woman stares at me, and Wayne's too busy knocking to see. "Muñeca," I say. She's black and unsmiling, and then the curtain drops between us, a whisper on the glass. She had on a t-shirt that said "No Problem," and didn't look like she owned the place. She looked more like the help, and couldn't have been older than 20, and from the thinness of her face, I pictured the rest of her skinny. We stared at each other for a second at the most. Not enough for me to notice the shape of her ears, or if her lips were chapped. I've fallen in love on less. Later in the truck, on the way back to the showroom, Wayne mutters, "This guy is dead. I mean it." The girlfriend calls sometimes, but not often. She's found herself a new boyfriend, some Sangano who works at a record store. Dan is his name. And the way she says it so painfully gringo makes the corners of my eyes narrow. The clothes I'm sure this guy tears from her when they both get home from work, the chokers, the rayon skirts from the warehouse, the lingerie, I bought with stolen money. And I'm glad that none of it was earned, straining my back against hundreds of pounds of raw rock. I'm glad for that. The last time I saw her in person was in Hoboken. She was with Dan, and hadn't yet told me about him, and hurried across the street in her high clogs to avoid me and my boys, who even then could sense me turning, turning into the motherfucker who put a fist through anything. She flung one hand in the air but didn't stop. A month before the Sangano, I went to her house, a friend visiting a friend, and her parents asked me how business was, as if I balanced the books or something. "Business is outstanding," I said. "That's really wonderful to hear," the father said. "You betcha." He asked me to help him mow his lawn, and while we were dribbling gas into the tank, he offered me a job. "A real one that you can build on. Utilities," he said, "is nothing to be ashamed of." Later the parents went into the den to watch the Giants lose. And she took me into her bathroom. She put on her makeup because we were going to a movie. "If I had your eyelashes, I'd be famous," she told me. The Giants started losing real bad. "I still love you," she said. And I was embarrassed for the two of us, the way I'm embarrassed at those afternoon talk shows where broken couples and unhappy families let their hearts hang out. "We're friends," I said. "And yes," she said. "Yes, we are." There wasn't much space, so I had to put my heels on the edge of the bathtub. The cross I'd given her dangled down on its silver chain, so I put it in my mouth to keep it from poking me in the eye. By the time we finished, my legs were bloodless, broomsticks inside my rolled-down baggies, and as her breathing got smaller and smaller against my neck, she said, "I do. I still do." Each payday I take out the old calculator and figure out how long it'd take me to buy a pool table, honestly. A top-of-the-line, three-piece slate affair doesn't come cheap. You have to buy sticks and balls and chalk and a scorekeeper and triangles and French tips if you're a fancy shooter. 2.5 years if I give up buying underwear and eat only pasta. But even this figure's bogus. Money's never stuck to me, ever. Most people don't realize how sophisticated pool tables are. Yes, tables have bolts and staples on the rails, but these suckers hold together mostly by gravity and by the precision of their construction. If you treat a good table right, it will outlast you. Believe me, cathedrals are built like that. There are Incan roads in the Andes that even today you couldn't work a knife between two of the cobblestones. The sewers that the Romans built in Bath were so good that they weren't replaced until the 1950s. That's the sort of thing I can believe in. These days I can build a table with my eyes closed. Depending on how rushed we are, I might build the table alone. Let Wayne watch until I need help putting on the slate. It's better when the customers stay out of our faces. How they react when we're done. How they run fingers on the lacquered rails and suck in their breath. The felt so tight you couldn't pluck it if you tried. "Beautiful," is what they say. And we always nod. Talc on our fingers. Nod again. Beautiful. The boss nearly kicked our asses over the gold crown. The customer, an asshole named Pruitt, called up crazy, said we were delinquent. That's how the boss put it, delinquent. We knew that's what the customer called us, because the boss doesn't use words like that. "Look, boss," I said, "we knocked like crazy. I mean, we knocked like federal marshals, like Paul Bunyan." The boss wasn't having it. "You fuckos," he said. "You butt hogs." He tore us for a good 2 minutes and then dismissed us. For most of that night, I didn't think I had a job, so I hit the bars, fantasizing that I would bump into this cabrón out with that black woman while me and my boys were cranked. But the next morning, Wayne came by with that gold crown again. Both of us had hangovers. "One more time," he said. "An extra delivery. No overtime." We hammered on the door for 10 minutes, but no one answered. I jimmied with the windows and the back door, and I could have sworn I heard her behind the patio door. I knocked hard and heard footsteps. We called the boss and told him what was what, and the boss called the house, but no one answered. "Okay," the boss said. "Get those card tables done." That night, as we lined up the next day's paperwork, we got a call from Pruitt, and he didn't use the word delinquent. He wanted us to come late at night, but we were booked. 2 month waiting list, the boss reminded him. I looked over at Wayne and wondered how much money this guy was pouring into the boss's ear. Pruitt said he was contrite and determined, and asked us to come again. His maid was sure to let us in. "What the hell kind of name is Pruitt, anyway?" Wayne asks me when we swing onto the parkway. "Pato name," I say. "Anglo or some other bog people." "Probably a fucking banker. What's the first name?" "Just an initial. C." "Clarence Pruitt sounds about right." "Yeah, Clarence," Wayne yucks. Pruitt. Most of our customers have names like this. Court case names. Woolley, Maynard, Gas, Binder. But the people from my town, our names, you see on convicts or coupled together on boxing cards. We take our time. Go to the Rio Diner, blow an hour on all the dough we have in our pockets. Wayne is talking about Charlene, and I'm leaning my head against a thick pane of glass. Pruitt's neighborhood has recently gone up, and only his court is complete. Gravel roams off this way and that, shaky. You could see inside the other houses, their newly formed guts. Nail heads bright and sharp on the fresh timber. Wrinkled blue tarps protect wiring and fresh plaster. The driveways are mud, and on each lawn stand huge stacks of sod. We park in front of Pruitt's house and bang on the door. I give Wayne a hard look when I see no car in the garage.
"Yes?"
I hear a voice inside say.
"We're the delivery guys,"
I yell. A bolt slides, a lock turns, the door opens. She stands in our way, wearing black shorts and a gloss of red in her lips, and I'm sweating.
"Come in, yes?"
She stands back from the door, holding it open. "Sounds like Spanish," Wayne says. "No shit," I say, switching over. "Do you remember me?"
"No,"
she says. I look over at Wayne. "Can you believe this?"
"I can believe anything, kid."
"You heard us, didn't you? The other day, that was you." She shrugs and opens the door wider.
"You better tell her to prop that with a chair."
Wayne heads back to unlock the truck. "You hold that door," I say. We've had our share of delivery trouble.
trucks break down,